This ties in so beautifully with COSC 345, one of my little slogans: if you didn't write it, you didn't wrong it. And getting a concurrent structure right can be quite tricky, especially if you're trying to use some sort of framework. And so what we would really like to do would be to have something that gives us some building blocks that hide all the details. And we can just plug in what's different about our problem. And if that sounds like object orientation, that's because it is. Although I'm sure many Erlangers wouldn't like me saying it. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to start with map. We're going to look at parallel map and discuss some problems with it. And I'm going to introduce you to a variant of spawn called spawn link. And there's a number of reasons for that. I'm going to talk about another problem with PMAP. I'm going to talk about the idea of supervision, and I'm going to talk about behaviours. And behaviours are sort of the climax of the lecture, which is where I say, hey, there's a bunch of stuff already there, and this is concurrency stuff that you don't have to write, you can just use it. Okay. Now, I actually happen to know that these things are, in fact, useful in practice, and that people writing telecoms applications have been able to do most of their task using the existing behaviours and not writing any actual concurrency code of their own, just gluing together existing patterns. There is a material out there on how to write your own patterns, and there's another pattern library, the EC2 library, where the guy said, I think I can do something much simpler, and did. Never mind, there it is. So here's map. Now, what is the idea that map is expressing here? It's expressing the idea of doing the same thing to several different data items. And there's no connection between these things. Okay? Do those get called first and then that one, or is it the other way around, or do you even care? Okay. Now, this is, there are, if we take Fortran as an example, Fortran has two kind of counted loops. There's a do loop, which is a sequential iteration, and there's the for all loop, which is notionally parallel. The order's not specified. We've got the same thing in C using OpenMPI. OpenMP. We can say, hey, here's a for loop. And we can say, hey, by the way, annotation, pragma, OpenMP, parallel for. I was looking at a thing called Panini, which is an extension of Java, and they use for the sequential and for each. Okay, so we've got this idea that sometimes the order in which you do things matters and sometimes it does not. So if we've got something where the order in which these things happen doesn't matter, then why don't we do them in parallel? And so here's parallel map. And it's not particularly complicated, really. It's just a bit of elaboration of the other one. So, obviously, when there's nothing left to do, we do nothing. If there is something to do, we've got a recursive call on the remaining data items. And we've got create a separate process to work on this first element. So here, we create a process. This process calls F on that first element X, and it sends the result back to this process. And the complexity here is, this is how you've got to do that so that this can find its parent. And then we receive
why are we calling self in passively?
We want to make sure that we receive the right messages in the right order.
So we receive the message from here and put it back together in the argument.
And that's actually pretty darn simple. One issue here is the size of the mailbox of the process that's running PMAP itself. And that is, to keep this simple, I wrote it where we pick up the messages in reverse order. So if all of these things take the same time, what we're going to have is we're going to have the mailbox fill up with fx1, fx2, fxm. And we're going to pull the last message out first. So you really don't want to do this with a list of a million items. It's not going to be a good idea. It's not going to be a good idea to use this on long lists at all. So that's possibly one problem to think about here. Now, when something looks too good to be true, it probably is. That is, not true. Okay. This is simple, and if everything goes right, it's fine. But as programmers and software engineers, we have to have this habit of looking at stuff and saying, how can I break this? What could possibly go wrong? I was listening to somebody this morning who said he'd been involved with two companies where they'd invested in a new approach to their business. And because of one bug in the implementation, it cost them a day's business, and they withdrew their hand back and said, we don't care how good or how appropriate this technology is, that one bug means we're not interested. We don't want to lose business like that. And the other guy I was listening to said, but you have to expect bugs. You have to expect them. We've got such complicated software now, we're never going to get it right. Failures are normal. Okay. So we have to look at this and say, what could go wrong? Well, this is built in, that can't possibly fail. What happens? Oh, here's the thing that I didn't actually discuss. What happens if you give this bad data? What happens if, for example, okay, what happens if we say PMAP if 1. Okay. If we give PMAP something that starts out like a list, but it ends in something that's not a list, then we'll start off this first process. Then neither of these clauses will match because A isn't a non-empty list, and it's not an empty list either. So this function will crash. And if we're catching errors, because Erlang does have exception handling, if we're catching errors, the reply from the first child process that we created will sit around in the mailbox forever. That's a bad thing. Okay? So we have to say, look, if this function itself crashes, we might need to do some cleanup. Okay, now one way around that is to say, why don't we just trundle down the thing first, checking to see if it is a list, and then do the recursion after it's been, given the overheads of creating a new process, just walking over this to make sure it is a list is probably worthwhile. I just thought of that during this lecture because, hey, you know, thinking about this, what could go wrong? And I didn't approach it systematically. So that's the first thing. Well, one trivial hack would be to say, if it's not a list, if it's anything else, return the anything else unchanged. That would sort of turn the error into not an error, but it would be very strange. Okay, spawn
well, this thing is a function of no argument, so spawn isn't going to go wrong. Receive, well, that's it either gets a message or it doesn't. Maybe there's a situation where it won't get a message. When might it not get a message? Well, this thing won't get a message if the child dies before sending the message. So if one of these things crashes, then this receive is going to wait forever.
And we might try to deal with that by passing in a timeout, but how do you... you never know how long to make a timeout. Okay? This is a really fundamental thing about timeouts. You never know how long to make them. You can sort of tune it. Here's a new thing about Erlang that I haven't told you about before. Erlang started out as a fairly pure functional language, and then they had a client, a customer, who said, look, I really, really need this. And they caved in and said, okay, you can have it. And there's this thing called the process dictionary. And in effect, each process has a hash table. Now, you can change the mapping from keys to values in that table, but you can't mutate the values. So technically, you could actually model this by passing around the dictionary as a parameter. So each one of these three functions returns the old value associated with the key. So array says, if this thing used to have a value, return it. If it didn't have a value, return undefined. Whatever, make sure it doesn't have a value now. Get key gives you the value, or undefined if it has a value, if it doesn't have a value. Put key value tells you what the value used to be, or is it undefined. How can you tell the difference between a key having the value undefined and a key not having a value? You can't. Don't do that. In fact, don't use the process dictionary without a great deal of thought. The thing about this is, when you fork off a process in Unix, it copies a whole lot of stuff. One of the things it copies is the environment variables. So the environment variables of Unix process are a bit like the process dictionary in Erlang. But Erlang spawning does not copy that dictionary. So if you were doing some mapping, if you were mapping over something, and that function was using get to pick up information out of the process dictionary, and then you change that from a sequential map to a parallel map, it will break because it's not the same process dictionary. So there are, and of course, if any of these things engage in any communication, they will have different process identifiers. So these new child processes, for example, will not be able to receive messages that are sent to the parent. So you could, for example, do a map down a list receiving messages. And if you run that using PMAP, it's not going to work because those messages won't be sent to those processes. Okay. So this thing about you're now working in a different process and that could break things. Well, the only real answer to that is don't do that. Okay. But the one that we mentioned before is if one of these new processes, PMAP, will wait forever. And so we need a way to deal with that. We might want to catch the crash and try to recover from it in some way. But basically, you know, if one of these things crashes, if you call the map function and one of those subcomputations fails, the whole thing will fail. You're not going to return a result. What we want to do is to arrange that if one of these new processes crashes before it can send a reply, we want to take down everything. And this is one of the things you don't find emphasized in most stuff about concurrent programming, and I can't for the life of me figure out why. Okay, there are facilities in Ada. To be honest with you, I don't know how you would do this in Java. I mean, Java has concurrency, it's got threads and so on. I don't know how you do this in Java. I probably would know if I cared all that much, to be honest. But in Erlang, this idea that one of the fundamental concepts and the way you go about writing Erlang programs is this idea that failure is normal. In fact, I've got to give you this. It is such fun. 70 maxims. Here we go. The 70 maxims of maximally effective mercenaries. Can you read those? Probably not. So, pillage, then burn. Okay. If violence wasn't your last resort, you failed to resort to enough of it. If the food is good enough, the grunts will stop complaining about the incoming fire. Everything is airdroppable at least once. That's one of my favourites. This is the one I want, number 70. Failure is not an option, it is mandatory. The option is whether or not to let failure be the last thing you do. If you can't carry cash, carry a weapon. I'm a great fan of Schlock Mercenary. It's a very moral webcomic in many ways. So in Erlang, there's this concept that you should prepare for subcomputations to fail. It is going to be normal. In fact, there is a slogan, let it crash. The idea in Erlang is that you normally should not even think about exception handling. If something goes wrong in a process, you should just let that process crash. And why? Well, you know, something's gone wrong. If you knew enough about what could go wrong to handle the exception, you wouldn't have made it an exception in the first place. Okay? If you knew what to do, you'd have done it. And how does it go? There was a science fiction story back in the 60s, quite a short one really, in which the following is told, that there was a committee set up to review pornography, and they reviewed this prostitute's biography, and the summary was, mens sana in corpore san, a healthy mind and a healthy body. They were given Janet and John Go to the Beach, a children's story, and they wrote a report which was a masterpiece of depravity, and then killed themselves so as not to corrupt others. Well, this is the thing that happens in biology. I don't know what that is, and I can't see it. Apoptosis. Programmed self-cell death. Between 50 and 70,000 million cells die each day in the average human adult due to apoptosis. It's a regulated and controlled process. Now, part of it is actually deliberately carving things out. But in the intrinsic pathway, the cell kills itself because it senses cell stress. And the other one is... it's our main protection against cancer. Okay. If a cell detects that it's going a bit wrong, it's supposed to kill itself. If it doesn't kill itself, it can turn into a cancer. And that can kill the whole organism. So the idea here is, I mean, for example, if a cell gets infected, well, it can destroy itself, and if it destroys itself quickly enough, say the virus won't propagate, or the other infectious organism will die. So the idea here is you make your program a lot of processes, and a process's state is encapsulated, and if a process says, no, I think I'm starting to go a little bit mad, bang! And you haven't corrupted the rest of the program. Right?
This is not confined to Erlang.
The Minix operating system. I'm going on about this length because it is really an important structuring idea. Minix. Driver resurrection. Minix is an operating system. In fact, it was what Linux started out as. Here we go. And Minix is a microkernel. You know, the actual kernel that you've got to trust is pretty small. So small that one person can comfortably read it in a reasonable amount of time. I've really got to try that. You know, so 13,000 lines of code for the microkernel. Okay. At 100 lines an hour, that's 130 hours, call it 3 weeks of really intense, careful reading. In fact, there's a book describing it. But device drivers in Minix are separate processes. What is the commonest cause of crashes in Windows?
Drivers?
Yeah, third-party drivers. The Windows kernel is actually, I hate to say this, not that shabby. But because third-party drivers execute in the kernel address space, if they've got a bug, they can take down the whole machine. In Minix, the drivers are out in separate processes. If a driver misbehaves, it's automatically and transparently restarted without rebooting. Okay? They call it resurrection. Okay, and so one of the reasons this works, and this is something which we don't really have time to go into in detail, many errors are transient. In fact, there's this whole class of things called single transient errors. Okay. A transient fault in a logic circuit resulting from a single particle hit is often referred to as a single event transient, and an error in a memory element is called a soft error or single event upset. Okay. So we've got this idea where the system itself is basically sound, but there's a fairly rare occurrence from outside that temporarily zaps it. If you try it again, it will work. Back in the days of MS-DOS, if a floppy disk read failed, you could retry it. And why did that make sense? Because sometimes there was a particle of dirt or something, and the retry would accidentally brush it aside, and it would work the second time. So we've got this idea that actually a lot of faults, or if there's a corruption in a database that you can recreate, that you can recreate a sound version, then actually starting from a sound version, you might not hit the path that corrupted it. It might actually work next time. So seriously, Sorry, I've got to do this. This is the one, Tom Knight and Lisp Machine.
A novice was trying to fix a broken Lisp machine by turning the power off and on. Knight, seeing what the student was doing, spoke sternly, "You cannot fix a machine by just power cycling it with no understanding of what's going wrong." Knight turned the machine off and on. The machine worked.
This is probably true, actually. I mean, Knight was one of the guys who designed these machines. Anyway. So quite often, if something goes wrong, and you kill the thing that's going wrong, and you start a new one, it's going to work. Or at least it'll work long enough to get something done. Okay, so it's very important to be able to notice the death of a process, and you should think about handling the death rather than preventing it. And the two techniques are called monitoring and linking, and there's a bit of history here. Originally they had linking but not monitoring. They added monitoring to monitor remote nodes, and then they said, oh, we could monitor other things as well. So let me talk about monitor. Now, okay, one thing you really need to know if you're doing this bit is Erlang documentation. We're going to use this. And all right, take your time then. So there are references to books and things, and this is where most of the library stuff is. There's the kernel, and there's stdlib, and stdlib is worth knowing about. The only thing you really need from kernel is the Erlang module itself. Okay, and so we've got so there's the monitor function there. And it says, well, what are the arguments? And so this one is saying that if you can call it with the first argument being process, or with it being port, or with it being time, and then there's monitor node, which can monitor a node. Okay. So the documentation is there. You can get the details from that. The key thing here is if you say, I want to watch that process, gives you back a unique token which you can use to cancel it, or which you can use to identify that message. And if there are three things, if the process didn't exist, you get this message with that thing being no proc. If connection was lost, you get this message with info being no connection. Or if that process crashed, you get this message with that thing being the reason why it crashed. Now, there is one sort of gotcha here, that if you've lost connection to a process, you don't actually know whether it is alive or dead. Okay. Fundamental thing about distribution, if you lose a path, if you lose communication with another node, you don't know if that node is alive or dead. Erlang uses a heartbeat strategy. There's a periodic, when you've got a bunch of nodes connected, each of them periodically sends out a signal to all the other ones to say, I'm still alive. And if you don't get that, there's a timeout and you're told, hey, that probably died. But maybe just the wire got cut. Now, the thing about this message, it gets sent once and only once because, hey, the thing's dead.
Once the time's up, can you come back or...
It could come back, and then you're rather confused.
So you want to ignore or mark it as dead or something?
Well, you simply treat it as dead, and this is the thing about timeouts in general. Okay, you never, as a general rule, you never know whether something is just late or it's never going to happen.
Okay. I was just asking for Erlang, actually. Erlang treats the process the time dot is.
If you've got two nodes, mm-hmm. you've got Erlang running on both of them. Okay, this one knows perfectly well it's not dead. This one hasn't heard from it in a long time, and it presumes it is dead. Okay, I've got to give you. This is a fun. This business about loss of communication means you can't tell whether something is alive or dead. Is a fundamental problem. Does this thing have a search facility? Yes. Here we go. This is an actual legal case. Lowering the bar is a very funny log about. There is a man sitting in the courtroom. He appears to be in good health, but by the end of the hearing, that man was dead. He'd also been dead when he walked in, so nothing really changed. So this guy had been declared legally dead. He appeared at a hearing to prove he wasn't dead, but the judge said, okay, you're still legally dead. So we can't expect a programming language to solve this problem if the court system can't. There's this presumed decedent's law, and it's a presumption for the deaf person. If somebody has disappeared and hasn't been heard from in 5 years, this is American law, or disappeared less than 5 years ago after being exposed to a specific peril of death. So if somebody falls overboard on the high seas, you don't really have to take seriously the idea that they might have swum 100 kilometres to safety. So if somebody is interested, like suppose great uncle Harry has left you $10 million in his will and he hasn't been heard of for the last 6 years, you can go court to court and say, you know, this is what's not happened. Can you declare him legally dead? And if he's declared legally dead, you inherit his property. Whoa! And then he comes home with his new wife and says, actually, I'm not dead. I want my stuff back. Tough. You were dead. You're still dead. Okay. This is the property of a legally dead person can be distributed as if he or she was in fact dead. He'd been missing for 8 years. And in 1986, he'd last been heard of. He'd been away from 19 years. Oh dear. So this is a problem. It's a real problem in the real world, even, let alone the computing world. You can't know. If you don't hear from somebody, you have to presume. If you don't hear from somebody long enough, you have to presume that you're not going to hear from them again. And if it turns out that you do, you've got problems. Now, we've got another problem here, and it's a timing window, and I don't know if you're familiar with that concept. Here's the problem. The parent process creates a child using spawn, and then it calls monitor. What happens if the child process died between those two events? So, parent creates process, process crashes, parent calls monitor, and then the parent is told, what do you mean? There's no such process. It doesn't get told what there is. Now, Unix deals with this differently. When a Unix process dies, it's turned into a thing called a zombie. And a zombie is a process record in the Unix kernel that has just enough information to tell you why it died. And then, so when the parent process gets around to calling the wait function to say, tell me about the status of my child, at that point the zombie is wrecked. The parent's told, this is what the state of your little process is. So the memory goes away, the file connections go away, but in the death certificate, as it were, remains until somebody asks for it. And then if the parent dies without getting it, then this thing gets wrecked by process one. So we would like to get the exit reason. If the process died quickly enough, we won't get that. We will get told that it's not alive, but we won't get told why. And so this is a... We've seen this before. We've seen this kind of thing when I talked about here's the bank account thing or whatever, or the transfer keys between two tables, whatever. We've got two operations, and each of these operations is atomic, but they're not atomic when you put them together. That combination isn't atomic. And so things can happen in between. You've always got to watch out for that. Now, let's face it, monitor is a little bit like an assignment statement. It's changing some information. It's telling that process, hey, when you die, or just before you die, send your death certificate here. And so it's this is one of the important things that Erlang lets us get away from side effects most of the time, but not always. What can we do with something like this? Well, what we need is an atomic operation that combines starting the process and setting the monitoring. Or we could program it. Whoops. LaTeX formatting error there, I'm sorry. That should be an underscore, not a dollar sign. Okay, so pretend for the moment that that's an underscore. Okay. So we create a process, and the first thing it does is it waits. Now, with the underscore there, it's not going to die. It's just going to be sitting there waiting. So we create, we having created the process, we monitor it, and now we send it a message. It doesn't actually matter what the message is. It's going to ignore. The only thing that matters is the fact of receiving the message. So this goes to sleep until we've done this. And you can play this trick anytime you need to. That says, I actually need to do a bunch of things, like maybe setting the priority or whatever. And I've had to do this fairly often in Smalltalk. Real Smalltalk systems let you create a process, a thread, in a suspended state. And so you can create the thing, you can set its priority, you can do a bunch of other stuff, and then you can say, now wake up. My Smalltalk is based on the C, the POSIX thread library, which doesn't give you the ability to create a thread in a suspended state. So I can't do that, so I have to do this. I have to set up a mutex or something. No, a semaphore typically. And I have to say, wait for a message. And then go ahead. So this little bit of nonsense here is there simply in order to work around this timing window. Now, when we've done this, we could put this code in the code for PMAP. We can say we're expecting to receive one of two messages. Either the process died, and so this will tell us we're passing these things in to make sure that we're talking about that particular process. If it died, we handle that. If it returned an answer, we handle that. So that's one way we can notice the death of a child process and respond to it. The problem now is that if one of the children dies, any others that are still running become completely pointless. We like to kill them. Erlang is Medea. Okay, so we've got spawn underscore monitor that does both of these things, but it doesn't cover everything. Okay, now this brings us to the concept of linking. And the thing is that links are bidirectional. There's the built-in function link that creates a link. There's the built-in function unlink that creates a, that removes a link. These things don't count. It's not reference counting. So if you call link 57 times with the same arguments, and then you call unlink once, the link's gone. In fact, normally these days you don't ever call either of these functions that you just mentioned for completeness. The thing is that if two processes are linked and either of them crashes, the other one will receive an exit signal. Now that's a technical term in Erlang. It doesn't mean a message yet. Okay, the notice is sent out and then the runtime system says, now what does the receiving process want to do about this? If you don't do anything else, the receiving process will crash with the same reason as the first process that crashed. Now, the thing about this is if you set up a bunch of processes working on the same thing, and then you can set things up so that if one of them dies, so that the task as a whole can't be completed, they all die, which is what you want. I mean, if you've got a Unix, suppose you set up a pipe running 10 Unix commands. You want them all to go away if one of them dies. That's what link is good for. But sometimes you want to respond to this. And so there's this concept of trapping exit signals. And if the process is trapping exit signals, it gets a message. It gets told, something died, this is what died, that's why it died. And it can respond to it. And this one is done by, there's a function called process flag, which has a ridiculous number of options. That's not the one I process flag. So we've got trap exit, error handler, minimum heap size, binary virtual heap size, okay, memory management things. You can actually kill a thing if it runs out of memory. You can message queue data. It says where are they are going, where the messages are going to be stored. What's the priority? Most of the stuff you just never bother with. Okay, you really don't. The one thing that might be useful is this trap exit thing. Now the thing about this is not something that's normally done in application code, because by the time you start messing around with receiving exit messages, your code is starting to get a bit difficult to read. What normally happens is that you identify a pattern of concurrency where this is useful and you encapsulate that. You turn it into a building block that you can reuse. Now again, with link, as with monitor, there's a timing window and we can use the same pattern with waiting for a message and then sending a message to resume it. But again, there is a built-in function called, oh, there's a typo there. Adged should be and. Spawn link atomically creates a process and links to it. Okay. So, by the way, if you want to trap the death of that process, you had better set trapping exits to true before you create the new process. Because if you call spawn link and the new process dies immediately, then you're never going to get as far as setting trapping exits to true. You've got to do that first. Now, it's very there's this function called spawn of two arguments where you've got a function as before and you've got a node. You can have a whole bunch of nodes set up as a group, and you can spawn processes on other nodes, and you talk to them just like you talk to a local process. That's how Erlang does local area distribution. And you can spawn and link to a process on another node, where if the other node seems to have gone down, you'll get a message telling you, hey, this thing seems to have died. Now, ordinary application code does use spawn link. It's generally how you're going to start something. Now, there's another issue here with using PMAP, and that is it creates too much concurrency. Erlang processes are particularly cheap to create, but they're not free. They do take up about 3/4 of a kilobyte of space, minimum. Okay, if you've got 16 gigabytes of memory, then creating a million of these things is no deal, no big deal. But if you've got 4 megabytes or 8 megabytes, it probably is. If you're doing this for speed up, you don't want to have a lot more active processes than you have cores. Okay. So you really want to think about, first of all, have exactly as many processes as you need to model the concurrent structure of your problem. Then feel free to create additional processes for particular reasons, like fault isolation. But this thing always creates quite a lot of processes. And so throttling is this business about saying don't overload the system with too many active processes. Processes that are sleeping, waiting for something to happen, not a problem. Processes that are ready to run or trying to run, you've got a problem, a performance issue. Any programming language. Well, here's the kind of thing we can do. And again, this is oversimplified. But so this says, let's just create 4 processes. So we split the argument list into 4 pieces. The details don't matter. We operate, that should be matfpar. We operate on each of the parts, and then we map down, picking up the answers, and join the pieces. How split four and join four have to be consistent, it doesn't really matter what they do. Now, the point that I'm making here is that it's starting to get complicated. It's starting to get to be the kind of thing you don't want to rewrite yourself. You want a function that does this. You don't want to be writing this pattern out by hand yourself. Okay. Let's see another thing here. We've got a pattern. It's got a number of names, sometimes called fork join. There are related things called fork join and master worker or marker slaves, master slave. We've got 2 reusable components here, and 1 reusable component does everything in parallel. The other one does things in batches. Now, the thing about this is when the gang of... You're all familiar with the concept of design patterns? Okay. When the design patterns book came out, the imperative world and the object-oriented programming world, at least the non-small-talk object-oriented programming world, went wild with excitement about this. What did the Lisp and small-talk programmers say? They said a design pattern is a thing that your language doesn't let you express directly. There shouldn't be any. Okay. if you've got a pattern that's that useful, your language ought to let you write it up and just plain use it. So that's why I say prefer components to patterns. See, a pattern is an approach. If you follow the Gang of Four, pattern's an approach. If you follow that approach, you're doing something sensible, but your code still needs to be tested. It's new code. If you've got a component that embodies one of these patterns and you use that, you're using tested code. Right. So here's an example of something that looks sequential but doesn't have to be. This is one of the things we talked about last week, and it says we're folding over a list, and it looks as though it's sequential because there is this dependency. We can't do anything with element 2 until we've done something with element 1. Okay, so we've got this strict sequence here, which is why it matters that it's fold L rather than fold R. And for an arbitrary binary function, it is sequential. But what happens if you're doing something like adding up or taking the maximum or the minimum or the union of sets or the intersection of sets? Okay. If you've got an associative operation, it doesn't have to be done left to right or right to left. It can be done in parallel. And just to make the code a bit simpler, I decided to demonstrate this with a binary tree. And so here we're folding over a binary tree, and there are two alternatives. There could be a leaf with a value in it, or there could be a fork with two subtrees. There are lots of ways of doing this. This is just what I chose for simplicity. And so there's two functions, f, what to do with a fork, and l, what to do with a leaf. So if we've got a leaf, we just apply the leaf function to the leaf data. Otherwise, we want to work on the two subtrees in parallel. Well, one of the processes might as well be the process we got. So we'll do this with just one new process. So we create a process to work on, let's say, it doesn't really matter which way we do it, the right subtree. We work on the left subtree. We pick up the result of the other process, and we combine the results. And this is going to give us the right answer because we're restricting it to associative functions. Now, this is not going to create as many new processes. As the other, it's going to create about half as many. We're still going to want to use spawn link for this. But again, this is a building block, and it says, hey, this is how you can work on a bunch of things and then combine the results. And you must have heard the phrase, Matt. MapReduce. Now, the idea of MapReduce is that you want to summarize a very large database. Now, this was originally developed at Google, and let me just Google keep huge numbers of individual log records. They're on a massive system. Where, amongst other things, at all times at least one computer is failing. So they needed a system that could distribute work out, and that when the analysis of some particular chunk failed because the computer that was doing it failed, that the work could be automatically restarted somewhere else. That's one of the reasons they needed a a database system with replication so that one machine dies, okay, you lose access to one replica of the data, but the other replicas are okay. And Rob Pike, one of the great Unix people, developed a programming language called Sawzall. Now, the thing about this was they had a vast amount of C++. People were doing these analyses in C++, and it was extremely difficult, despite the fact that they had a framework, and the framework was something like 20,000 lines of C++, and fitting in with it was complicated. So he designed a language based on Orc, and the Orc program has a map phase. You part of the Sawzall script is the F part of a parallel map, and part of it is the aggregation part of a parallel fold. Okay. So the cool thing about this was that, again, this is basically a functional language. So you've got lists, maps, and structures. Assignments create copies. Cycles are impossible. And so here we go.
That declares some data structures. This declares the input, and these are the summary things to be done. And Hadoop has a similar language called Pig.
My tolerance for cutesy names is diminishing with age. Okay. So that particular combination, map plus fold, is, you know, huge amounts of computer time are devoted to that pattern. And the fact that you could express in a few lines of code something that would take maybe 1,000 lines of rather brittle C++, they didn't care that this thing wasn't, in itself, wasn't the world's fastest language. What mattered was the management of communications and data storage and error tolerance. So you've got this, you've got a tiny script, and behind it there's tens of thousands of lines of C++. Okay. Very, very sensible way to build a system. So here's a quotation from the Wikipedia, and let's go back to Wikipedia. Algorithmic skeletons. Whoops, that's right. Thank you, Mr. Autocorrect. So I've quoted that second paragraph there. Algorithmic skeletons, they're a high-level parallel programming model for parallel and distributed computing. They give advantage of common programming patterns to hide the complexity of parallel and distributed applications. And this page is well worth a read. We'll come back to it. Okay. Oh, basic ETIV patterns. You can tell I hadn't had enough sleep when I wrote that. The thing about this is algorithmic skeletons are patterns. They are typically also reusable code. And you can write new ones. You can identify new problems. You should be able to combine them. You should be able to identify new ones. Now, here's one of the building blocks that goes into Erlang patterns. And this is the supervision concept, which we've already talked about with link and monitor. Now, the thing about supervision here is you've got a process that's the parent process, and you're monitoring or linking to a number of child processes. These are doing something for you. And the children are pointless. Okay, if the supervisor dies, the children are pointless. Okay, the children exist to carry out work, and they might be talking to each other. Okay, they're not necessarily, you know, pure parallel. They would be independent, doing their own thing, but they could be talking to each other. They could be talking over network connections. Here's an example of supervision. You've got a web server. And the web server receives requests and it farms them off to children. Typically great. And if a child dies, you might want to reconnect to that client and say, I'm sorry, this service died. What do you want to do now? Okay. Now here, the thing is, the supervisor in this case, when we were talking about PMAP and whatnot, we were talking about a setup where the supervisor really is the master. It's there to control what work gets done. The master sets what the purpose of it all is. And if that can't be done, everything might as well die. When you've got a client server set up, client server is not the same as master worker. When you've got a client server set up, the children, the thing that are actually serving the web requests, they're what it's all about. The supervisor is not there to control. It's there to resurrect the dead. Okay? It's there to say, oops, that piece of work died. I'd better re-establish the connection and start up a new one to try and deal with it. Okay. The supervisor is still on top, but it's not really the boss. It's there to provide this resurrection service. So the idea is that the supervisor gets to make a choice. What happens if children die? Well, a child, you might decide to kill everything. You might decide to kill everything and restart the whole thing. You might restart that one process. You might make do without. And at this point, there's a document which I would very much like you to read. I'm not going to say it's one of these things where you've got to read it through to get the idea, and then you read it again to get a few of the details. And I don't really care about the details. The details are not in the exam. Okay, the exams have been written and sent off, and I'm going to try and make really sure that I cover in the lectures everything that is in the exam. So I'm after concepts rather than details most of the time. But this is one of the things they did in Erlang. They said, well, okay, we can do all of these things, but they developed a framework. Okay, OTP stands for Open Telecom Platform. And they were trying to teach Erlang to people, and they were saying, well, here's a typical kind of situation you'll come across. They started teaching design patterns. And they said, hang on a minute. Why are we teaching people how to write this code? They shouldn't be writing this code. They should just be using it. And so they set up this framework called the Open Telecom Platform, which is simply the library that comes standard with Erlang. And so a behavior is an Erlang module that embodies a particular concurrent pattern. And these things are integrated into the simple application something library. They've got a framework for how these things can get started up. There's there are configuration files for you to describe, say, here is a service, and it depends, it starts in this module and it depends on these other modules so that you can make automatic loading and hot loading done automatically. So they set up these things. If you actually look at the code, some of these modules are extremely complicated. They're not complicated because the basic idea is complicated. They're complicated because they're plugging into a framework that supports all of these things: automatic startup, automatic clean termination, reloading, logging. And the core pattern. And so in order to be reused, these things have to be parameterized somehow, and the question arises, how? So if we go back to Erlang documentation, reference manual, is that the one? No, I think it's user's guide. Erlang OTP design principles. Yeah. Now, in previous years, I used to print this and hand it out. I guarantee you, this is in the exam, the idea of a supervision tree and what supervision is all about. What is the purpose of supervision? What is it good for? Workers are processes that perform computations. They do the actual work. Supervisors monitor the behavior of workers. A supervisor can restart a worker if something goes wrong. A supervision tree is a hierarchical arrangement of code into supervisors and workers, which makes it possible to design and program fault-tolerant software. That's the point. And they've got a picture here that says, hey, look, this thing can be a tree. What's a behavior? In a supervision tree, many of these things have similar structures. Behaviors are formalizations of common patterns, finite state machines, event handlers, client server. The idea is to divide the code into a generic part, which you get to reuse, and a callback module. This is how it's parameterized. Okay. The thing calls back to a module. When you want something to be an instance of a particular behavior, you start up a copy of that behavior and say call back into this module for the problem-specific parts. And so if we look at supervisor, let's look at gen server. Now, the client-server idea you're already familiar with. You've got a server, and you've got clients that connect to it and get replies. And here's what it looks like. Can you see that?
We started with the module name. We say that it is using a behavior. One of the things that Erlang did long before it had a type checker was to check this. When you say that this thing is a behavior, the Erlang compiler knows what callbacks the behavior needs, and we check to make sure that you've got all of them. And so here they are. And so here we've got starting it up, and this we'll get to a bit later. This is a function that can be called from the outside, and this is a call, and this one here is a broadcast. Here we're saying, and so here, so this actually goes in two steps. First of all, from the outside, somebody will call alloc. That will call to this, which goes into the gen server module for running an instance here. And then the code in here calls back to call, gets mapped to handle call. And so this is, okay, let's do something. And here's the reply to send back. And a multicast gets turned into this. Cast. What's the difference? This is a alloc. It's a synchronous message. The sender is expecting a reply. This one is asynchronous. They're not expecting a reply. Now,
I think you'll agree about on two things here. First of all, it's pretty mysterious until you've read the documentation. It's not instantly obvious exactly what's going on here. You can sort of figure out, okay, there's some startup and there is some messages that are synchronous and there are some messages that are asynchronous. Fine. But it's still pretty mysterious. But another thing I think you can agree about is that there's nothing here that looks concurrent. There's nothing here that requires mastering concurrency. You just say, okay, I want this thing to run, and this is how to initialize the state, and these are some functions that have, you've got some stuff here that's, so the start link, handle call, handle cast, and init. They are required by GenServer. The other functions are the service that this particular thing provides. So, again, we don't have to deal with process. There's no mean. There is a process identified being passed around in there, which is that one, but you don't have to pay any attention to it. So it's a whole lot easier to develop a client-server thing this way once you know what to do. Okay, so the key thing here is you start this, and this does a whole bunch of things. So it says, what's the name of the new thing? And there's several ways there to do it. The second thing happens to include the same word. It's what is the name of the callback module, and then the callback functions are init, handle call, and handle cast. And so this is the argument list to be passed to init, and there's a list of options, and there are quite a lot of them. Okay. But this thing, you know, quite a lot of people write Erlang code that is largely GenService. They've also got finite state machines. That one's recently been replaced, and I'm not familiar with the new one. The old one was Gen. You can tell that it's new because the other ones are spelled in English spelling, and that one's spelled in American spelling. But here's supervisor, and here's supervision principles. Supervisor is responsible for starting, stopping, and monitoring its child processes, and the basic idea is it keeps its child processes alive by restarting them when necessary. And so when you call this thing up, so here's how we start this thing, and it's doing two important things. One of them, it's saying what the children look like. Now, this particular one just has one child. It's a list of one element. And the so this says, how do we call this thing? Now, this is actually a little bit of code. And there's some history here. And the history is important. When Erlang started out, it did not have anonymous functions. If you wanted to refer to a piece of code, you passed around a tuple consisting of a module name, a function name, and a list of arguments. And then when you got one of these things, you could append more arguments and then call the result using a built-in function called apply, with three arguments, module, function, and arguments.
So this is what we've got here. We've got an MFA triple, module, function, argument list, and this is going to be called to start the new child. You can have any number of children, and each one has its own description. Restart here says,
what kind of child is this? Is this supposed to be hanging around forever? Or is it transient or a bunch of other things?
And here we've got, what are you supposed to do if this thing is shut down? And the answer here is, well, you just don't even kill the child. And what modules does this depend on? So we make sure that these modules are loaded before it starts. The other thing is we've got some strategies. There's a strategy here that says, this is saying, what are we going to do when a child dies? And this one says, if a child dies, restart that child. And this is why it's important to have the child specification as a data structure, because if we want to restart a child, how do we do that? We do that by looking at its description. So the actual GEN supervisor module is going to keep track. There is going to be a process that keeps track of this. This has to do with, and I don't propose to go into detail, but this is the kind of problem that comes up. It's one of the reasons we want something that does this for us. I've said that quite often a problem is just transient. It's going to go away. So that turning the machine on and off again, off and on again, if you understand the underlying problem, or call Tom Knight, will cause the thing to work. But what if it's not the case? What if, now, my laptop developed a habit of turning itself off. It hasn't done that now for over a week. David Ayer's laptop turned itself off permanently for presumably similar but slightly different reasons. In my case, power cycling worked. In his case, it didn't. Doesn't matter how often you power cycle the machine, it just was not going to work. And keeping on trying is just a total waste of time. So what this is saying is basically, in any 5-second period, allow one restart. But if it fails more frequently than that, give up.
Okay. Now, making that happen requires programming work that you probably wouldn't do if it hadn't already been done for you. Now, there's a lot more detail here, and frankly, I am feeling crook. So I've pointed you now to is the OTP Design Principles User's Guide. This is the thing to read, and it's a really important thing. It's not exclusive to Erlang. Now, here's the thing. There are two reasons why you use a callback module rather than passing in functions. There's a historical reason, and then there's actually a really good reason to keep it that way. The historical reason was that these behaviors were initially created when they didn't have anonymous functions. The good reason to keep it that way is that we can replace whole modules. We can do the hot loading. So if we've got a... This is part of the reason why the code behind these things is actually fairly complex. If we have a process that's running a behavior, we can say, upgrade to a new version of the underlying module. And it can take care of transferring the current state to the new module. Okay, but if it was done using anonymous functions, that wouldn't work in because they would still be the same anonymous function. So this is all about supporting hot loading as well. Now, If this was just a fact about Erlang, there would be... I wouldn't really have an excuse to spend a lecture on it, on this idea of saying having reusable concurrency building blocks is a great idea. But the parallel programming people years ago ran into the same issue, and they came up with this idea of algorithmic skeletons. And so there are some well-known patterns: farmers, master, slave, task replication. That's our PMAP. Farm, it's our PMAP. Pipe, that's a staged computation. That's pipeline parallelism. That's Unix pipelines. You say, here's a bunch of functions, run them in parallel, and then start feeding things in at one end, and let the data trickle on through. Okay, that's actually pretty easy to program. That would be a great assignment, I suppose, but never mind. For is fixed iteration, while is conditional iteration, if, map, split, execute, merge, that was sometimes called fork join, divide and conquer. Again, these things are trivial to program in a language like Erlang. When I say trivial, you can spend 10 minutes writing the program and a day debugging it. But I don't really like doing these things by extending Java. Just seems so wrong. But anyway, here is the interesting thing. Frameworks and libraries, existing stuff that does this. Okay, so that's quite a lot. So here we go, in staple skeleton framework, skeletons are defined as parametric data flow graphs, letting them scale beyond 100,000 cores. Composition of skeletons is point-to-point correspondence of the... This framework eliminates the need for re-implementation and global synchronizations in composed skeletons. Supports nested composition, can switch. Okay. So this is a typical sort of thing. If you need to do concurrent or parallel programming, it's really worth looking for something like this, for some library of reusable components that implement patterns. So T4P, for example, has these things done as higher order functions. And so there's a comparison of these things, and we see, for example, what language do they use to actually do the work? What language do they have for expressing the problem? How do they just do the work? And so we've got TCP/IP, we've got MPI, the message passing interface. Is it type safe? And so on. And Eden is a rather interesting one. Eden is still around, and it's done in Haskell, and it's got quite a lot of support there. And T4P, I'm afraid, is... But we've got some things that are built on top of Java. And this is quite interesting. Fastflow, still current, and it handles GPUs as well as CPUs. And, of course, we've got things on top of Java as well as on top of C++. Staple is another current one. In fact, look at this. We've got maps, zip, we've got a whole lot of stuff in here. Again, if I had to do parallel programming or concurrent programming in C++, I would definitely look into Staple. Because this is complicated stuff that you want to use once and only once. And about at this point, I am all talked out. I have now got assignment 2 from everybody, so I should get your marks back within a week for that. And people have started handing in assignment three. Good on you. And actually,